Willkommen zum Hi-Podcast mit Sophie Ronschka und Christoph Käse.
Hier ist das erste deutsche Fernsehen mit der Tagesschau.
In der Kernfusionsforschung wurde ein neuer Weltrekord aufgestellt. Forschende am Europäischen Kernfusionsforschungszentrum JET registrierten bei der Verschmelzung von Atomkernen nämlich einen größeren Energiegewinn als je zuvor. Das wurde heute auf einer Pressekonferenz am Standort des Europäischen Forschungsreaktors in der Nähe von Oxford in Großbritannien bekannt gegeben. Die Kernfusion gilt als mögliche Energiequelle der Zukunft.
Guten Morgen, Sophie.
Guten Morgen, Christoph. Heute widmen wir uns wieder einem unserer Lieblingsthemen, richtig? Es geht um Kernfusion. Vor einigen Wochen hatten wir schon einmal ausführlich darüber berichtet. Und für alle die das nachhören möchten, es war die Folge 270 vom 6. Februar. Auf dem Gebiet passiert gerade so enorm viel in kurzer Zeit, dass wir heute noch einmal weiter in die Tiefe gehen wollen. Und das machen wir in einem ganz besonderen Format, nämlich in einer Doppelfolge. Warum? Weil es über dieses Thema so viel zu wissen und zu sagen gibt, dass eine einzige Folge nicht ausreichen würde. Daher wird es eine Doppelfolge.
Genau, und ich glaube, wir können versprechen, dass es wirklich spannend wird. Denn wir haben einen Gast gefunden, der uns das Thema so gut, so plastisch und so kompetent erklären kann, wie kaum jemand anders in Europa.
Es ist allerhöchste Zeit, mehr Aufmerksamkeit auf die Kernfusion zu richten, denn beinahe wöchentlich kommen neue wissenschaftliche Durchbrüche zum Vorschein. Wir haben gerade eben die Tagesschau von vor einem Monat gehört. Die Rede war von einem Durchbruch in Großbritannien, nicht zu verwechseln mit dem Durchbruch Ende vergangenen Jahres in den USA. Aber was bedeutet das alles und wo stehen wir gerade?
Nuclear fusion used to be a rather sleepy research area, but in the past years there's been dramatic progress. All right, it hasn't yet saved the world, but when it comes to saving the world, nuclear fusion has a pretty good shot, literally.
Das war die theoretische Physikerin Sabine Hossenfelder in ihrem YouTube-Kanal Science with Sabine. Auch sie bestätigt, auf dem einst verschlafenen Feld der Kernfusion überschlagen sich aktuell die Nachrichten. Auf geht es also in diese Doppelfolge. In der ersten Ausgabe, also heute, beschäftigen wir uns mit den physikalischen Grundlagen. Worum geht es bei der Kernfusion eigentlich? Wodurch unterscheidet sie sich von der Kernspaltung? Warum verspricht sie so viel mehr Heil und Segen als die Spaltung von Atomkernen? Und was passiert da eigentlich genau im Detail?
Und für alle, die jetzt sagen, von Physik, davon verstehe ich gar nichts und ich finde es langweilig, bitte dranbleiben. Es wird richtig spannend und jede und jeder kann folgen. Ganz sicher versprochen.
In der zweiten Folge dann, also in der kommenden Woche, geht es darum, wie Kernfusion kommerziell nutzbar gemacht werden könnte und wie unsere Energieversorgung dann aussehen würde, wenn großtechnische Nutzung wirklich möglich wäre. Sind dann wirklich alle unsere Energiesorgen behoben? Welche Auswirkungen hätte das auf Politik, Geopolitik und Gesellschaft? Dazu also mehr in der kommenden Woche. Starten wir in die Folge, oder Christoph?
Auf geht's in diese Folge und zwar mit einem ganz besonderen Gast.
Der Hi-Podcast mit Sophie Ronschka und Christoph Käse. Unser Gast heute ist
Leben Koblenz.
Leben Koblenz ist einer der führenden Köpfe von ITER, dem internationalen Großforschungsprojekt zur Kernfusion. ITER sitzt in Südfrankreich in der Nähe von Aix-en-Provence. Dort entsteht der größte, teuerste und anspruchsvollste Kernfusionsreaktor der Welt. Aufgaben des internationalen Großprojekts ist es, die wissenschaftliche und ingenieurtechnische Herausforderung der Kernfusion zu erschließen, um der Menschheit diese Energieform zugänglich zu machen. ITER ist eine Art CERN für Kernfusion, bloß mit einem größeren Fokus auf praktische Umsetzung. Leben Koblenz vertritt ITER nach außen. Aus den USA stammend hat er sich sein Leben lang mit Wissenschaft und Energiegewinnung beschäftigt. Er hat für die US-Aufsichtsbehörde für Kernenergie gearbeitet, ebenso wie für den US-Senat und die Internationale Atomenergiekommission. Schon seit September 2016 ist er bei ITER. Er kennt jede wissenschaftliche Debatte, jede ingenieurtechnische Herausforderung und jedes Startup auf dem Gebiet der Kernfusion. Und er ist ein begnadeter Erklärer und Ausdeuter von Wissenschaft. Hören wir, was ihr besprochen habt.
Leben, thanks for joining us. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Christoph.
Just to establish your role, you're working for ITER, the International Collaborational Institute for Bringing About Fusion Energy. What exactly is ITER?
So ITER is kind of like you could think of as a research institute or a national lab, but it is a convergent national laboratory on fusion in the south of France, sponsored by 35 countries. It's a 35-country collaboration.
So it's a bit like CERN, is it?
It's kind of like CERN, except if I look out the window on the ITER work site, the seven flags that you see flying there with the European Union is flying right next to China, and Russia is flying right next to the United States. So, and in between, you have Korea and India and Japan. So the grouping of countries that are working together to build this largest ever industrial scale fusion device is not your normal set of allies. It's not necessarily a group that is ideologically aligned, but they made a 40-year commitment to make this happen because they believe in the importance of this for future generations.
Mm-hmm. What is the mission that your member states set you to fulfill?
When we put that in a sentence, we say to demonstrate the feasibility of fusion power, fusion energy, at industrial scale. When you put it into a mathematical formula, you want to build a tokamak, which is a form of a device for producing fusion energy, that gets 10 times more heat energy out of the tokamak than the heat energy in. So it's a gain factor of 10. That's the mathematical certification. And if you talk to a plasma physicist, they will tell you that the purpose of ITER is for the first time in human history to give scientists an opportunity to study what we call a burning plasma or a largely self-heating plasma, which I can explain.
We come to that in a minute. Now let's talk through some physical basics. We're talking about atomic level. And there are two ways of dealing with atoms, is either splitting them, which is called fission, and the other, the opposite, is fusion, merging them. Can you explain in simple words the difference between splitting and merging atoms?
So in both cases, the Einstein formula of E equals mc squared applies, which means that you are taking a very tiny amount of matter and converting it to a very large amount of energy in a spectacular reaction. But the difference is that in a fission reactor, which is basically all the nuclear that you know for nuclear energy has always been fission. We've had that since the 1950s. In that reaction, you are sending a neutron into the middle of a uranium nucleus and splitting it apart. So when you do that, you get waste products. You get really two different other subjects, two different isotopes, two different elements, and you get more neutrons. So that's a chain reaction. Those neutrons go on to split other uranium. So you have a chain reaction, waste products, and if you control it properly, a huge amount of energy. In fusion, fusion is actually the most abundant source of energy in the universe. We would not be alive if we're not for fusion, because at the center of our sun, you have hydrogen. We think of it like a big ball of gas, but in fact, the hydrogen at the center of the sun is about 70 times the density of steel. So the hydrogen nuclei, which are just a proton-proton interaction, is they are being fused by gravitational force, just pressure. The sun is about 300,000 times the mass of Earth. So that is how you fuse them, which also means it's impossible to do it that way on Earth, because you can't use gravitation as a way to replicate that energy of the sun.
Okay, let's come back to uranium again. Uranium is a very heavy element. The number that it's listed in the periodic table of elements is 235 or 238, somewhere in that region. So it's very heavy. It's like a billiard pool full of billiard balls, and you kind of split it. It needs some starting energy, and then a chain reaction starts. In fusion, you're doing the absolute opposite. You're taking some of the lightest elements available.
Yeah, so if you look at a normal nuclear fission reactor, you would have about 200 to 300 tons of uranium, or maybe byproducts, or maybe plutonium. But you would have about that amount. And so you are running water through the middle of it to try to keep it cool and also to interact with the physics of it. And as I said, then you have waste products and you have to control the reaction and so forth. If you don't control that reaction, you can have a meltdown. You can have a Chernobyl, et cetera. If you want the same size of, say, facility, power production, in fusion, instead of 200 or 300 tons of uranium, you would have 2 or 3 grams of hydrogen, two forms of hydrogen. Yeah, grams.
How much is it? Is it a truckload? Is it a regular car full of? So how heavy, if I were to lift uranium,
oh my,
how heavy would it be?
Well, I would say if you look at a fully loaded 747 jetliner, that's a little over 300 tons. So it's about that amount of just fuel.
Mm-hmm. And in fusion, you just have, let's say, a shot glass, like a little
less.
Like you if have you were about, to drink vodka.
Yeah, it's about the weight of a few peppercorns.
Okay, and what's in there?
So it's two forms of hydrogen. You will all remember, all of our listeners will remember from their secondary school physics class that you have in an atom, you have a nucleus and you have electrons going around. In a hydrogen atom, which is the lightest element, you only have a proton. That's all you've got, one proton. You can add a neutron to that, and then we would call it, instead of a normal hydrogen atom, you call it deuterium, but it would still look and taste and feel exactly like all the characteristics of hydrogen, but it would now weigh twice as much. That's deuterium. And if you add two neutrons, then you would have tritium. So in the type of fusion that we're working on, you would have a deuterium gas and a tritium gas that are both 2 to 3 grams of this material, half and half. You put that gas into a very, very large chamber. You run a current through it. And by running a current through it, it's very much like what you see in a light bulb. When you run a fluorescent light bulb has gas in it, you run a current through it and it lights up. Why? Because what happens there is called ionization and you get a plasma. So we know commonly about solids and liquids and gas. Plasma is the fourth state of matter. It's like a gas, except that the molecules have been, or the atoms have been split. You have the nuclei charged that are moving around at random in the gas, and you have the electrons that are also charged. So the ionized gas is what you get as the basis, as the fuel for fusion.
You just mentioned that you add a neutron to get from regular hydrogen to deuterium and then to tritium. And a neutron adds mass, but it's not charged. It's not electrically charged. So it adds mass, but not a charge.
Right. So when you have the deuterium nucleus, it is one proton, one neutron. So that nucleus would still have the same charge as a hydrogen nucleus. If you add two neutrons to the to make a tritium nucleus, same thing would happen. But those particles would still be charged because they're a nucleus with a proton in it. However, when you get them up to a super high temperature, because remember that for particles, temperature is equivalent to velocity. If you tried to bring two of those particles together, both positively charged, they would repel each other. But if you get up to a really high temperature, 150 million degrees, which is 10 times hotter than the core of the sun, those particles will be going so fast that when they come together, they will overcome their natural resistance and they will collide and they will fuse. And from that, you will get another charged particle, which is a helium nucleus, and you will get a free neutron. And that neutron, when it's by itself, has no charge and it's highly energetic, so it can escape a magnetic field and transfer its heat, and that heat can be harnessed as energy.
So basically what it does, it transforms hydrogen into helium. That's basically what's happening, right?
Exactly.
And when this helium atom has less mass than the combined mass of the two hydrogen atoms that you fused, right? Mm-hmm. So mass is being lost during that fusion. And the interesting thing is, due to Einstein, you quoted Einstein, E equals mc squared already, that when mass can be transformed into energy and energy can be transformed into mass, they're basically the same thing, colloquially put. So you take two hydrogens, you fuse them and the product helium has less mass than the two hydrogen atoms combined, and this sets free energy.
That's exactly right. It's well put. You got it. You can build a tokamak now, Christoph. You're ready.
Probably, I'm lacking the funds, probably. Now, that is fascinating. So basically, when you really run it to the bottom line, you're taking some kind of water in its gas state, which is steam, pretty much, right? Yeah. And you're heating up that steam to very, very high temperature. Now, you mentioned earlier that there's this enormous gravitation at the core of the sun. This is something we will probably never be able to mimic on Earth because we are not able to produce this kind of gravitation. But we're using a proxy, which is heat, is it?
Right.
And you mentioned that this kind of heat, which translates into movement of particles, has two effects. First of all, it makes two atoms meet, and then it overcomes the repelling force, the Abstoßungskraft auf Deutsch, right? So please explain us in a couple of words, Leben. Space on the atomic level is pretty much empty, is it? I mean, people always feel that it's some kind of solid mass, but most of the atomic space is empty because there's huge space between the electrons and the nuclei. And you need to kind of the nuclei to bump into each other, so you need to increase the likelihood of them bumping to each other, which you do by moving them around very quickly, which means heat. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So I'll say it this way. If you look at the announcement from a year ago or so of the National Ignition Facility in the United States, they did something that would seem a little bit more easy to understand because it's a little bit closer to what the sun does, in the sense that they put a couple of grams of deuterium tritium into this little peppercorn piece that was perfectly, perfectly, perfectly round. And then they shot 192 lasers from every direction at that. So they didn't have gravitation, but they managed to put extreme pressure on that as well as some heat. And that's how they achieved fusion. It's inertial confinement. That's what it's called, done with lasers. At ITER and other tokamaks or stellarators, what we do is we have a big, if it's a tokamak, it's a big round donut-shaped chamber. And we put this little bit of gas, deuterium, tritium gas, into the chamber. And then we start by running a current through it, as you would through an electric light bulb. And that creates a pathway, an electrical pathway that you can map out that the charged particles are naturally drawn to. So you are actually helping to somewhat, not thoroughly, but somewhat control the direction of their movement. And then you use other heating systems, things like similar to what your microwave would be, a home microwave, but thousands and thousands of times more powerful. You use other heating systems to try to heat this up to this 150 million degrees. It's maybe a little bit less than that. And at that stage, you have if your chamber, your tokamak, your vacuum chamber is large enough, you create a sufficient number of fusion reactions that you get theoretically more energy out than energy that you put in. So there have actually been hundreds of these tokamaks that have been built so far, and we've seen fusion happen. We have seen, this is not science fiction. This is something that we know can happen. And we see that the amount out versus the amount in is influenced by density of the plasma, which we're not going to change very much. It's very light density. By the magnetic field strength, which is measured in something called Tesla, and in the size. So sheer size in this case makes a difference because you need the plasma, the chamber, to be large enough that you get a sufficient number of these fusion reactions.
So, Leben, the machine you're building is quite huge, is it? How big is it?
The vacuum vessel that we have here at ITER is about 830 cubic meters. So to put that in perspective, it's a radius on, it's like a donut, and each piece, each side of the donut is about 6 meters radius, plus a big magnet in the middle. So you go across the whole thing, you're talking about close to 20 meters. And then about 13 meters high. So it's quite large.
That's pretty much like a villa, right? 20 meters by 20 meters exactly. And 30 meters high. Yeah. It's a typical two-story villa. Let's say this kind of size. It's not a huge skyscraper, but you're only filling in this peppercorn of hydrogen. So why does it need to be so big for this little like shot glass full of material?
So the reason is we'd have to go into a bit more detailed physics. Mm-hmm. But what you will see is that we learned by doing. So the first tokamaks were tabletop size. They were not the size of a villa. This was something that we could demonstrate the general concepts. We could demonstrate what we call magnetic confinement, meaning that we have three different shaped magnets, one running down the middle, one that is circular in rings, and one that is T-shaped that actually goes around the vacuum vessel. And with these three, we create an invisible magnetic cage that is very identically shaped to the physical cage, and that's what holds the plasma in. But what we found as we mapped it was that if we made this donut, made this chamber bigger, we would get a directly proportional larger amount of fusion. So we could map it very directly. And when we got to the one that is called the Joint European Torus, that one is in Colham, England, near Oxford. That was the biggest, until recently, that was the biggest operating tokamak. And in that one, we got to a point where for 23 megawatts of heat put in, we got 16 megawatts of fusion out. So you can basically graph it. You show it experientially why you need a particular size of fusion device. Now, having said that, if your magnets are more powerful, ITER's magnets will get to about 10 or 11 Tesla, maybe even 13 Tesla at the heart of the biggest magnet.
By ways of comparison, just to mention that a typical Kernspintomograph, as we say in German, MRT or MRI in English, yeah, would have 1.5 Tesla.
Yeah.
And the most advanced machines you would find at your local radiologist would be 3 Tesla.
Yeah.
And you're running it up to like 4 times that magnetic, yes, field strength.
Yes.
Okay.
And doing that across a, as you said, a two-story villa, across a very, very large machine. Now, the recent achievements at some of the private sector startups have used what you call a high-temperature superconductor. So a superconductor is a substance that has no resistance when you run electricity through it. That's how we make the very powerful magnets. But ITER's magnets, which are made of niobium tin, niobium titanium, they have to be superconducting, we have to cool them all the way down to minus 269 degrees. Absolute zero is just minus 273. So we are just at 4 Kelvin, 4 degrees above absolute zero. And so this means that in the center of your machine, you've got the hottest point in the universe. And just a few meters away at the outside of the machine, in the middle of these magnets, you've got the temperature of interstellar space. So the engineering challenges are enormous. But these new magnets, these new superconductors, can operate at maybe 80 or 100 degrees Tesla. So they can operate at a higher temperature, sort of like a very, very severe refrigerator. And they have shown that they can get up to about, at a full-scale magnet, at about 25 Tesla. So you can make, theoretically, smaller machines because you can make this ratio of size, magnetic strength, and plasma density is what controls your energy output.
And you just said that this is the hottest spot in the universe. You're saying this because all the stars we know are somewhat comparable to the sun, which is not the hottest star, but we know how hot stars are.
Yeah.
And none of them is as hot as the 120 million degrees we're getting in these chambers. And that is man-made. So is it fair to say that man creates the highest temperature ever created in the universe? Or currently available in the universe?
I'd have to check that because, to be honest, you have other forms than stars in the universe. You have, when you look at lightning, when you look at the amazing photos coming back from the James Webb Telescope, you do have other forms of plasma which reach higher temperatures. But certainly to say that humans are creating something as, you know, the tiny creatures we are in our solar system on our little planet in the middle of this vast universe, and we are experimenting with something that goes 10 times hotter than our own star, is certainly a magnificent technological achievement.
Let's talk about efficiency. You alluded to that earlier, the so-called Q factor that everybody in that science field and that industry now talks of. What is the Q factor?
So the Q factor is how much heat are you getting out in contrast to how much heat are you putting in? So that would be the physics Q that all the plasma physicists designing these things are really interested in. If you are a commercial investor, you're interested in a completely different form of Q. You wouldn't even call it a Q, but that would be how much does it cost to build and how long do I have to operate it before I'm getting a return on my investment? Similarly, there are some who talk about an engineering Q, which means that at a commercial facility, you want to know how much electricity is consumed by my support systems. If I have a cooling system to cool these magnets, if I have a switchyard that sends the electricity into the magnets, if I have heating systems, how much electricity is all of that using? So I want to make sure that the electricity eventually that I'm producing in a commercial machine is many times higher than the electricity that I am consuming to power it.
So when talking about the engineering Q, so the amount of energy produced as opposed to the energy sucked up by the entire system, including cooling pumps, et cetera, there, the investors I was talking to, they're looking for a Q of 5, maybe. So the thing producing 5 times more energy than the entire system uses. What Q have we or have you achieved yet?
So far, nobody's broken to a Q of 1. I mean, I think the National Ignition Facility for that microsecond that they had break even, they had a Q that, depending on how you measure it, would probably be around 3. So they actually got to a higher Q, but that's for a microsecond. And then they have to build another pellet perfectly round and maybe, you know, 3 months later or something, do another experiment. So that's not a very efficient way to harness, but it is break even. It is more, you know, a Q that has more out than in. At ITER, our machine, based on what we have seen in all the other machines made, the size and the design of ITER is to get a Q across the plasma of 10. But ITER is not going to produce electricity. So we'll never get to a Q engineering that's more. In fact, we are designed like a national lab, as I said. So we're designed for inefficiency. We will have multiple heating systems so we can test different configurations. We'll have a lot of things that will have probably 10 times the diagnostics that you would have on a commercial device. So we're deliberately designed to help others design the machines of the future, to test as much of the integration of all of these systems and technologies as possible.
Leben, one last question for this week's episode before we continue our conversation next week. With all these decades of research being done and the Q not having reached break even yet, there's a lot of criticism in the market, but the counter argument I was just wanted to check on the numbers is that Q has improved by a factor of 10,000 over the past decades. So all the work done by scientists like ITER have increased Q by a factor of 10,000, not breaking even yet, but at getting up much higher. And for commercial viability, another step of the factor 10 would be needed. So 10,000 down, 10 to go. Is that oversimplified or does it come somewhere near the truth?
No, I mean, I think it is true. It is somewhere near the truth. I think that actually there's something in physics that's really important to understand. I talked to you about a burning plasma. This product that we didn't pay attention to, this helium nucleus that gets produced by the reaction, is actually a fourth heating system. It has much more energy than the other particles, so it can continue to heat. So if you get to a point where that alpha particle is the dominant form of heating, we call that a burning plasma. But theoretically, like you do in your fireplace, you get to ignition, That means that the only source of heating now is the fusion reaction itself. It is doing its own heating. In that circumstance, as long as you put wood into the fire or in a tokamak, as long as you keep adding the fuel, you will run without external heating. So there your Q would get much, much, much higher. So you would get for a pulse of, yes, probably a Q of 50 or something for a commercial device, which would be a Q of 5 engineering. But once the physics kicks in and you get to a completely self-heating plasma, your Q automatically goes much higher with ignition. So there's a physics lesson in there that influences that outcome.
Leben, thank you very much for today's installment on the basic of nuclear fusion. Next week, we're going to talk to you again, exploring what the world could look like if nuclear fusion works. Thanks for being with us this week.
Thank you, Christoph.
Und was schreibt ihr euch diese Woche auf den Merkzettel?
Ich nehme mit, Kernfusion erzeugt aktuell noch nicht mehr Energie, als sie benötigt. Doch die Effizienz nimmt ständig zu. Niemand kann genau sagen, wann Kernfusion praktisch eingesetzt wird, doch der Zeitraum scheint immer kürzer zu werden. Es entsteht zwar Radioaktivität, doch sie ist viel weniger und von viel kürzerer Dauer als bei der Kernspaltung.
Und ich nehme mit, Fusionsforschung wird aktuell nicht mehr nur mit öffentlichen Geldern betrieben, sondern es kommt immer mehr privates Kapital hinzu. Warum? Weil eine kommerzielle Anwendung in greifbare Nähe rückt und damit dieses Gebiet attraktiv und interessant für Investoren wird. Zweitens, es entsteht ein Ökosystem. Öffentliche und private Investoren arbeiten nicht gegeneinander, sondern miteinander. Ganz besonders um ITER, also wo Leben Koblenz arbeitet, in der Nähe von Aix-en-Provence entsteht ein richtiges Ökosystem. Um ITER herum siedeln sich viele Start-ups an, die Technologie weiterentwickeln, an unterschiedlichen Aspekten arbeiten, teilweise aber auch ganz unterschiedliche Wege gehen. Wir haben es also mit einem Ökosystem zu tun, das gar nicht so viel anders ist als Ökosystem in anderen Start-up-Gebieten. Und drittens, ITER ist zu einem Zentrum dieses Ökosystems geworden, und zwar zu einem weltweit führenden Zentrum. Die Europäer sind durch die Anwesenheit von ITER fast ebenso stark geworden bei diesem Gebiet wie die Vereinigten Staaten. Die europäischen Startups sind zwar immer noch unterfinanziert, technologisch aber an vorderster Front mit dabei. Diese Chance, die haben wir und die sollten wir nutzen. Kernfusion kann ein Zukunftsinnovations- und Technologiemotor, damit auch ein Wohlstandsmotor für die Europäer werden. Deswegen lohnt es sich, genau hinzuschauen. Und das war's auch schon mit dem HIGH-Podcast für diese Woche. In der kommenden Woche hören wir uns wieder um
5.55 Uhr, wie immer.
Und um die zweite Folge dieser Kernfusions-Doppelfolge zu hören. Also, bis dann.
Bis dann, tschüss.
Tschüss.
Das war der HIGH-Podcast für diese Woche. Wenn Sie keine Folge verpassen möchten, immer dienstags um 5.55 Uhr kommen wir heraus. Versprochen. Mögen Sie uns? Dann abonnieren Sie uns jetzt oder hinterlassen Sie einen Like. Wir freuen uns über Anregungen, Kritik und Wünsche. Schreiben Sie uns gerne an podcast@hai.co. Nicht .com, sondern .co. Eine Produktion der Axel Springer HAI GmbH, einer führenden Beratung für Strategie und Umsetzung neuer Geschäftsmodelle. Wir engagieren uns leidenschaftlich für das Wachstum Ihres Unternehmens.